Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. Welcome to special coverage of the Chauvin trial verdict. Of course, by now, you know that former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin has been convicted of all three of the counts with which he was charged. And since this is rare, I think it bears repeating. Guilty on second-degree murder, guilty on third-degree murder, guilty of manslaughter. Chauvin was handcuffed, glanced back over his shoulder as he was immediately remanded into custody. And when he's sentenced in 8 weeks, he may be going to prison for 40 years. Jubilation over the jury's decision followed the reading of the verdicts. But no one believes this is where the work ends. Remember, 20-year-old Dante Wright, who was unarmed, was killed by a police officer during the Chauvin trial. So how do we put these verdicts into context? What does it mean that other officers and the chief of police testified against Chauvin? What happens next? So we're going to hear from a number of guests. Your voices are really essential to this, too. Does this feel like the beginning of some kind of change? Does it feel like an exception to the rule? And I think a lot of us are asking, what would have happened if there had been no video? Would Chauvin have been acquitted if it was just the word of the bystanders? Think about some of those questions. Listen to how the conversation develops with our guests. And I'd love to hear what you think. If you've never called the show before, maybe you're working at 9 a.m. Hey, this is an opportunity to get in. I'd like to listen to what you have to say. I know our guests would too. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. And I'm on Twitter tonight. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Michelle Norris is a contributing columnist for The Washington Post and the founding director of the Race Card Project. She's from the Twin Cities. She's in Washington, D.C. And Michelle, welcome back to the show. It's good to talk to you again.
Carrie, it's always good to be with you.
Sandra Samuels is with us, president and CEO of the Northside Achievement Zone, founder of Healing Our City, a virtual prayer tent for Minneapolis. And Sandra, I am doubly grateful to have talked with you this morning and now again tonight. So thank you. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely, Carrie.
Okay, let the jubilation flow, Sandra. I just want to hear you. I want to hear you emote about this. Talk to me.
Okay, so first, let me just do it. Like, so just so you know, I have a glass of wine because I'm like, and we just left like George Floyd Square. And like, by the time I got there, all I've been doing is going. So I'm sorry. I just had to do that. I'm going to be like wild tonight, Carrie and Michelle. I hope you don't mind. And hi, Michelle.
Hi. Good to see you. And hi. No, I don't mind at all.
Yeah.
This is an evening for jubilation.
I know, I'm just so excited. I was like, I mean, just like whooping at every car, everything that moved. I whooped at dogs. I mean, you guys, it's just a great day. You know what this feels like, quite frankly? I was a delegate for President Obama when he was running to get the Democratic nomination, and we were down in Denver. And I remember after he got nominated, my husband and I looked at each other and we said, isn't the sun brighter today? And has the grass ever looked so green? So it's a similar feeling.
Sandra, one of the things we talked about this morning was the damaging and deserved reputation that Minnesota has put out there in the world. I mean, the headlines in the New York Times, Michelle has written about it in the Washington Post.
Yes.
So now this verdict, news of this verdict, is traveling around the world too. What does it say up against those images that we've all cringed about over the last year?
That we're not completely cray-cray? that we actually, you know, so what I'm hoping, and Carrie, I said this earlier, I'm hoping that the world over, and particularly in our country, that they know that they are Minnesota. So, yes, we have huge disparities, and ours are worse than anywhere else. And it makes sense, in fact, that a Chauvin would put his knee on a black man's neck here in Minnesota and it be captured. I mean, it just does. But today, you know, what I've been saying is we gave the world something to see with the murder of George Floyd. Let's give them something to see about what it means to walk in a redemptive mode, in a reparational mode, right? And I'm not saying that we did all of that today, but coming back after just, what was it, 10 hours
right.
with guilty,
right.
guilty, you know, that speaks volumes. It's not how far you fall. It is how you get up and if you get up. And I believe that we're getting up.
Michelle, I want you to hear what Hussein in St. Louis Park has to say about this. Hi, Hussein. Glad you called in. What are you thinking about?
I mean, like I said before, it gives me a hope that there's always too many Eric's bad cops there. What I'm saying is, I'm not saying all the cops, all the law enforcement are bad, but there is some bad ones that also still hiding from the law. What happened today gives me a hope that those bad cops are watching what happened today, and there is a justice. There is a justice one day that they will face.
Appreciate the call, Michelle.
Hussein, thank you for that. I hope all police officers, and we know they are watching what happened today and really thinking about it. I, you know, the questions that you asked at the beginning, Carrie, is this an exception? It is. It's rare for a police officer to be charged with murder for the killing of an unarmed suspect. Is this the beginning of the change? I hope so. But that's up to us. And by us, I mean all of us. And I also mean our police departments. So they know who these cops are. And they know that if they continue to behave unchecked like this, it debases the entire department. And what that one police officer did, think of everything that flowed from that.
Mm-hmm.
All the heartache,
mm-hmm.
all the trauma, all the hurt, all the property damage, all the damage to Minnesota's reputation. And so I hope at the end of this that my beloved state of Minnesota has always been known as the North Star State. And I hope in some ways that it will help reorient our national compass around policing and around the valuation of human life and human dignity.
You know, Michelle, one of the things that Sandra and I and others talked about this morning was this just gut punch of a piece that Dr. Myers wrote from the University of Minnesota. You saw it, front page of the Times. And in it, he says things like, look at the metrics. I mean, it's even worse when you're in a state that tells itself that it's progressive and that it doesn't have a racism problem. And so that allows us to ignore a lot of the metrics that he went through and listed that, again, I know you've also written about in the Post. I mean,
it is, and I, at this point, we can't ignore it. You know, because we see the evidence of it, and I hope that people are actually paying attention, not just to what happened in the 3700 block of Chicago Avenue, but what also is looking what is happening in housing, what's happening in education, the health disparities, the things that Professor Meyer spelled out. And it does make it harder when you are coming from a progressive mindset, when you are coming from a mindset, we've always done the right thing. It's almost like if you were... I know this is going to be a strange analogy, but just stay with me. If you were an athlete at some point, and you're no longer an athlete, and you keep walking by that mirror, and you keep seeing the former athlete, and then one day you look in the mirror and you realize, whoa, things have really changed. You know, I'm not the person that I used to be. And, you know, and maybe even more of us relate to that after the pandemic. But Minnesota and the country, I think, is having that moment. That mirror is being held up in front of us, and we are forced to reckon with what we see in that mirror. And we have a short attention span as a society, and we have to do what Darnella Frazier did. We have to keep looking at something that is painful to look at and not look away and tend to it and actually act upon these things that we can no longer ignore.
Darnella being the 17-year-old whose videotape changed the world, whose video of what was happening to George Floyd changed the world. Let me go to the phones here. And if you've just joined us, you're listening to special coverage of the verdicts on Derek Chauvin. You know that they were all guilty. Now we're listening to your voice tonight about what this means and whether this is an exception. But maybe it's the first foundational step to real change. And we'll talk about some of the elements of that. So to Maury in St. Paul. Hi, Maury. Thanks so much for waiting. I'm really glad you called.
Yeah, thank you. I live in St. Paul. I've been a lifelong Minnesota resident. And what I'm feeling tonight is just a sense of deep relief and deep gratitude to the people who put together such a solid case on the prosecution, to all the witnesses who came forward, and to the jury for, you know, delivering as close a measure of justice as can be had at this moment. I mean, I realize true justice would be this never having happened to begin with. But at this point, this is the best justice that the jury could have given, and they did that. And so I'm very grateful to them, and that I think this means we'll have peace tonight. But, you know, I think of myself as kind of a realistic optimist. I mean, I do have hope, but I do think that this case would not have gone the way it went if it weren't for such an airtight case being built by the prosecution, by the fact that they had the video, they had the witnesses, they had police officers testifying. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to change unless there continues to be sustained pressure on the powers that be. You know, I forget who said it, but just the idea that power concedes nothing without a demand. I think it was Angela Davis or who said that initially, but I completely agree with that. You know, people need to keep pushing. But I do want to encourage people to hope, because I think too often people fall into this pessimism, and they think that hope is the trap, you know, but it's not. Pessimism is the trap. If you just remain endlessly pessimistic and believe that nothing can ever change and nothing you do can ever make a difference, nothing ever will. And so even though it's hard to keep hope, don't fall into the pessimism of nothing can ever change, because that is the trap. Hope is not the trap.
Maury, it's really important. I mean, Sandra, nobody, I think, understands this better than you do. You know, to not let despair be overwhelming, to take the progress when you can find it. I mean, that's what you're doing every day at the Northside Achievement Zone. This resonates, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely, it resonates. And in fact, that's why we can do what we do, in terms of 30 organizations coming together, wrapping around families and children, really focused on the African-American community, low income in North Minneapolis, and providing all the wraparound supports, trying to get at the historic racial inequities that created North Minneapolis and the pockets of North Minneapolis that can sometimes feel so hopeless. And but we, you know, Carrie, I talked about this earlier. We're doing the work that we're doing, and I think everybody says it, because we have this understanding of history and how we got here, both the challenges but also the strength. And I mentioned earlier that soul force, you know, the a civil rights icon, Ruby Sales, who in 1965, the year I was born, she was on our prayer vigil, virtual prayer tent, Carrie, the Healing Our City. And we've had people come in from all over the country and give reflections. So Ruby was on like last week, 1965. She's in Alabama demonstrating with local African-American folks who are demonstrating against exploitive land owners who were exploiting African-American sharecroppers. And she's there, and Jonathan Daniels, a 26-year-old white seminarian, is with her, and there's a bunch of them. They all get a angry mob comes out of all these white folks. Ruby said there were, she was 17. There were weapons she'd never even seen before. The sheriff, knowing what was happening, loaded them up in a garbage truck, put them in jail. They stayed in jail for six days. Horrible conditions. A 17-year-old girl. I'm 55, right? They tried to get them to drink toilet water. By the time they got out, Ruby, there, she said they were parched, and they didn't want to be let out. They just got let out all of a sudden because they knew the fate of the three civil rights workers who got let out all of a sudden, and then they were murdered. And but she, another 17-year-old, the 26-year-old seminarian, a priest, were voted to go to the store and get them some drinks. They go to the store. A guy's there with a gun. He says, "I'm going to kill you, bitch." And Jonathan pulls Ruby's shirt, her blouse, and pulls her down. Jonathan jumps in the way, and Jonathan is killed.
Oh, my gosh.
Ruby did not speak for 6 months after that. And she said that racism killed Jonathan. Like, let's not make any mistake. And Ruby is in her 70s now. And she said, "I was able to make it through that period. And I'm still here, and I'm talking to you because of this soul force. And it's in us, Carrie. And it's in North Minneapolis. It's in South Minneapolis. It is the living hope that we have, that we are going to make it through." And it's like Michelle said, it's going to take all of us. So I'm not trying to be Pollyanna. But I know we keep moving the ball of hope down the court. Every generation does that. And this is our opportunity to do it and then to really take on our system of racism, of which the murder of black and brown people by police officers is just the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole iceberg that, and Michelle has written about it. You know, it's in the article you talked about. Everybody's talking about it. And it's the iceberg that is the iceberg of America.
Gen Z says, "Sandra, I hope it's the beginning of real change for the better. The sheer joy in Sandra's voice makes me smile even bigger than I already am." You're listening to special coverage tonight of the verdict in the Chauvin trial. Three guilties. You probably know that already. We're talking tonight with our guest, 2 hours of special coverage, about whether this is truly the beginning of some kind of change. Minnesota, as Sandra and Michelle have noted, have shown the world accountability tonight. That's important. That might be a foundational step. Mm-hmm. Is it an exception? Right. I know you've asked yourself, like I have, what if there hadn't been video? What if we were relying on the eyewitnesses and the testimony of police officers? So join into the discussion. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR to Barry in Minneapolis. Barry, you're an attorney, is that right?
I am an attorney. I'm a criminal defense attorney.
And you are calling to say Chauvin is not going to get 40 years?
Yeah, he's not going to get 40 years, and I really want the media to stop saying that because people are going to be very disappointed. The 40 years is a statutory maximum, which the legislature put into the statute before the Sentencing Guidelines Commission was created. When people are sentenced for crimes in Minnesota now, since the guidelines, they're sentenced according to the guidelines, and the guidelines sentence for this crime, which is a severity level 10, and assuming Chauvin has no criminal history, is 150 months, which is 12 and a half years.
So, Barry, question about that. I mean, what if Cahill departs upwards from that? And what if the sentences for each of the verdicts are served sequentially.
Consecutively.
Consecutively.
These are presumptively consecutive sentences. I take that back. They're not, actually. Under Minnesota law, Minnesota statute 609.035 for the law nerds, if the crime was one event, one operative event, then the judge can only sentence on one. He will only sentence on murder two. And yes, to answer your question, he can depart upward. It's called an aggravated durational departure. And he might depart upwards 10 months, 20 months, 30 months, but he will not depart to 40 years.
Okay. Well, that's sobering, Barry, and I'm glad you've called in to correct this. You sound like you know your stuff, so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, I just don't want people to be disappointed when he gets 12, 13 years, not 40 years.
I get it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Call here from Josh in Minneapolis in Dinkytown. Hi, Josh. Thank you for waiting. Hey, Josh, are you there? Okay, let me go to David in Richfield. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had to call when you asked the question about is the video enough? And I'm sorry, I'm a little shaken up here, but my wife and I were talking here at the table, and 30 years ago we had a film of Rodney King, and both of us were just shaking our head at why was that film not enough? Why did that not be enough? And I know it was for me, because when I saw that video 30 years ago, it was the first time in my life as a clueless white man that it's a very dangerous world out there for people who aren't like me. And that was my first realization that there are bad apples in that world of policing. And I know a lot of really great police officers who would take a bullet for anybody, but there's just enough bad apples out there that you have to have the video cameras, but they're not enough. You've got to have a ton of them, and you've got to have a phone in everybody's hand, and you've got to have, the cameras on and microphones.
Yeah, the work
and
of this.
On the officers themselves, because that's what it takes for us to believe something we've never personally experienced, and that's what it took for me.
Michelle, do you think that's right?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm old enough to remember the Rodney King trial and the events afterwards,
same
the
here.
Insurrection afterwards. We as a country our country has changed a lot. Policing has changed a lot, and the magnifying glass that we place upon policing in the country has changed. And the jury pool in Simi Valley was very different than the jury pool that we saw in Minneapolis, a very diverse jury pool that, you know, in their questionnaire talked about their views on policing and Black Lives Matter, things that you couldn't, you know, that discussion you couldn't even imagine in Simi Valley when that case was tried. But to the question of the video, it, you know, we do have to imagine, boy, what would things be different if we didn't have the bystander video? These convictions might well remain rare if it takes all of this evidence, the video, the bystanders, the EMTs, the police crossing the blue line of loyalty. But that video in particular, because if you look at the original statement that was issued by police on May 25th, I don't know if people remember that, but, you know, the headline on that was man dies after medical incident during police interaction. And they were, you know, writing at that moment when they didn't know a lot. But if you go, it's chilling to go back and look at that statement now, because there is nothing said about a knee on the neck. It's, you know, they were responding to someone who had a counterfeit bill. He appeared to be on some sort of substance. He physically resisted officers. Officers were able to get the suspect into handcuffs and noted that he appeared to be suffering medical distress. They called for an ambulance. He was transported to Hennepin County Medical Center by ambulance, and he died sometime later. Compare that to then the video. When Darnella Frazier took the video, posted it on Facebook, that statement was issued a couple of hours before that video went viral. It's not clear that we would have seen the body cam footage until trial. We may have never seen it because we know in some cases the cameras aren't working or something happens. So without that bystander video and without the number of bystanders and their composition, there was a public servant, there was a child with an even younger child, there was a you know, the older man who came, and the 61 years old, who drove around the block and went back in his van to go back and try to stand as witness to what was happening to George Floyd. You know, these were bystanders who were acting as good Samaritans, and we should note that Minnesota was the first state to pass a Good Samaritan law back in the 1980s. Many states now have them on the books, but Minnesota was the first to do that. And it's one of the reasons it was so strange to see the defense try to portray the bystanders as a mob that might somehow become, you know, unruly. But that video clearly made a difference in this case. And we are left to wonder, if there wasn't video, what would have happened? And if this happens again, and we almost kind of have to say when this happens again, how will that case be adjudicated if it's not captured on video?
Or and if the video isn't as complete as this was,
right?
Let me take a call from Allie in Waconia. Allie, it sounds like you wanted to talk about the video.
Yeah. First, I want to say I am a proud Northside teacher, and I work at a NAV school, so I really appreciate having that perspective on here. Also, I also wanted to say about the video, in my opinion, the verdict would not have been guilty if there wasn't a full video. Even with the full video, I've been keeping track of the case, looking at comments on social media, which I know can be really dangerous if you're emotionally involved. But so many people in my community, I'm white, so many white people in our state still don't believe he's guilty of murder after watching the video from beginning to end. And so the willful ignorance that is so present in my community that I don't even understand is I'm hopeful, but at the same time, there's a fear, and it seems much deeper than it seems like it goes so deep. It's hard to root out, and yeah, that's all I wanted to say is if there wasn't a video, there's in my opinion, there's no way he would have been found guilty.
Sandra, when I think about that, I think about the you know, it'd be interesting. I think we're going to talk with former St. Paul Police Chief Bill Finney about this in the second hour, because I'd really love to hear what he has to say about this. But that's a burden. That's a weight to carry around, you know, for citizens and for police officers. That's not the way that we want to build a community, is it?
No, it absolutely isn't. And this is where... So as we talk about the redoing, transforming policing, changing policing, and I am not for dismantling or getting away, you know, on getting rid of police, nor defunding. I feel like there's enough money for all the other things that we have to do. I mean, we got money in this state. We have money for education. We have money for early childhood. We have money for housing. It's do we have the will for those things? And when you live in communities like mine and in North Minneapolis, in South Minneapolis by George Floyd Square, where, you know, last year there were 84 people murdered. The majority were from my neighborhood. This year so far, there have been 21 people murdered. 85% of them have been African-American men. 83% of them between 17 and 21 years old. Thursday before Dante Wright was murdered, a 16-year-old was shot in the back in front of my office simply by another teenager, simply because he said he wasn't in a gang. He wasn't in a set. That was the question. What set are you in? And he said, I'm not in a set. And he got shot. And then one of my other partners, early childhood, just the other day, and by the way, there was a murder this morning at 2 a.m., but she said that the day before yesterday, a 15-year-old got shot in front of her place. So I say all that to say there are some major, like, we have got to fix policing. And it has to be a both-and, Carrie. Like, accountability, real structural change, that happens both in terms of how policing happens, but also in terms of the laws that shape policing that our legislators and policymakers have the power to change, like they didn't change the arbitration rules when they had an opportunity to, which have over the last few decades, when police chiefs have fired men and women like Chauvin, who have cost the city millions of dollars in lawsuits. And I know this, you know, personally. My husband was on city council for about 11 years and would come home frustrated about it. With three different police chiefs, by the way, 50% of the time when they would fire someone like a Chauvin, they would have to, because of arbitration, union rules, need to rehire them, forced to rehire them. And so, you know, I might be meandering, but the main thing that I'm trying to say is it is hopeless. We cannot rely on somebody with a smartphone.
Right.
We have got to be moving to a system of accountability that relies on the system itself. And we can do it. The question is, will we do it?
Saundra Carrie, Samuels is just, with us. Yeah, Michelle, I just want to remind listeners of what they're listening to. Mm-hmm. Saundra Samuels is president and CEO of the Northside Achievement Zone, founder of Healing Our City. Michelle Norris is a contributing columnist for The Washington Post and part of our special coverage on the Chauvin verdict. Michelle, go right ahead.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to respond to something that Allie had said earlier about people who think that Derek Chauvin is not guilty, that George Floyd had done something to, you know, perhaps bring this on himself. And that needs to be addressed also. Because of the work I do in the Race Card Project, I hear from people a lot. I talk to people a lot. And there are people who, for instance, Saundra, will listen to some of the statistics you just ticked through and believe that police, that a very tough brand of policing is needed to protect them from those people, to protect them and keep their neighborhoods safe from people who are doing dangerous things. And that's a very dangerous mindset, because that is basically condoning police to be not just there to protect and to serve, but to execute without any kind of criminal proceeding. And so one of the things that has to happen is including the community in this sort of renewed thinking about police reform and understanding what police are there to do, and understanding that even if you live in, you know, a neighborhood that you perceive to be safe because the police are protecting you from the scary people who live someplace else, that your life is connected to them and that your fortune is connected and your future is connected to them. And so that policing reform and the conversation about systemic change goes beyond just policing and includes the valuation of human life that we express through how we educate our children, through how we provide housing for certain people, how we provide pathways to opportunities for people, because all of these statistics will change if people are valued in that way and that they have better opportunities. And we don't just look at the police department as there to protect one community from encroachment by another community. This is the difficult thing that we must admit to in American policing is at its roots go back to a system that was basically meant to protect white supremacy and to limit the movement and aspirations of black and brown people that might challenge the status quo. And that is not the way that we would describe policing today, but it is the origin story of policing, and some vestige of that still remains in policing throughout America. And until we admit that and figure out how to root that out, it's going to be very difficult to make the kind of systemic change that we need to make in America.
We're going to talk about an element of that next hour, which is some of the questions that have come up about the Dante Wright incident and compliance. There has been some really good writing. Ibram X. Kendi, by the way, just posted a column about the idea of compliance on The Atlantic, but we'll get to that in the second hour of our special coverage. I want to grab a call here from Lori in Worthington. Lori, it sounds like you spent some part of your career as a police officer. Is that right?
That's correct. I was a police officer for 26 years in the state of Minnesota here.
I'd love to know what you're thinking as you listen to this discussion.
I started my career in Minneapolis, and before I moved to rural Minnesota, there's a lot of police officers that have been sickened by watching what happened and are rejoicing also in this verdict. I've got a lot of loved ones, a lot of people I care about that are standing in the breach to, you know, in the cities now, to keep the peace there. And that's just what they're trying to do. So there's many of us that are also not ever in any of my training was I taught that technique. None of us were. And so to have watched this, many of us have been sickened by it and are also happy that he is going to be held responsible for what happened.
Lori, I'm wondering, you heard earlier maybe that Sandra and Michelle and I were talking about the stain on Minneapolis and the stain on policing that this showed the world. When you're with your friends from, you know, your former law enforcement colleagues, what do you say about that?
To all of us, you know, we're all held in, you know, not as individuals, but that we're all cast into this net that we're all like that. That's how we act. That's what we do. And that is just totally so not right. You know, as just like we should be looking at everybody else as an individual, no matter what color their skin, no matter their economic status, none of that. But as police officers, we get cast into that same net that we're all the same too. And I think that everybody needs to start looking at people as an individual. And I think that we could have some understanding of each other once we start looking at each other as not just a uniform, but that there's a person that has family and loved ones behind that, just like everyone.
Sandra, this is challenging, though. I mean, in the middle of the Chauvin trial, we have the Dante. The numbers are deeply distressing. What do you think about what Lori is saying?
Yeah, so let me say, I have police officers that I love. They are human beings who have an incredibly, like, I wouldn't do that job. In a good time, I wouldn't do that job. There's Mark Kluko. I love Mark. I talked to Mark today, and I didn't talk to him today, but I say, Mark, he's a police officer, and I'm like, Mark, I love you. I love Chief Arredondo, our first African-American police chief who grew up on the South Side, who sued the police department himself for racism, who took a knee after George Floyd was murdered, who testified and said, we don't do that. He's the first one to break the blue code. I love Mike Kirchen. Like, I could go on, Carrie, and it's true. And I'm holding two things. I love these people who are part of a system, okay? And it is a system where that has Michelle said it. Its origins have been that we are going to police white people one way, and we're going to police black people another way. That, I mean, this is America. And again, we have to come to grips with that. And so you have people and you have systems. And you can love people, and they are part of systems that are oppressive. They are part of systems that are steeped in white supremacy. And just whiteness, the culture of whiteness. And so, you know, I tell you, what I keep saying, and they're all systems like that. Really quick, there was the cops always used to say over here in North Minneapolis and other communities that one of the reasons they can't solve crimes is because there's this code on the streets of not snitching. Snitches get stitches, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, y'all saying that on the streets there's a code of snitches get stitches? Well, there's a code in the police department that snitches get stitches. You know, like police who see other bad cops have known not to say anything because they don't want to lose their cover in a tight spot. Like, I'm just giving one example, but they don't. Carrie, tonight, I heard the chant. So we were out at George Floyd Square. For me, it was important to be there, but downtown, I hear they were chanting, "We got one, we got three more to go." I have forgotten about the other three. In my reverie about today, it was like, and then I heard, "Oh yeah, we do. We got three more cops to prosecute," who stood there and watched and saw how heinous it was. And at least one was saying, "Well, you know, maybe we should turn them over." Right. And they were Chauvin's trainees. Right. But that they didn't have enough wherewithal to see that this man was murdering this man. And all of the bystanders are trying to slap him. They're slapping him, you know, metaphorically. Look at him. Just look at him. He's not breathing. Three stood there and watched. And so this is also true of the system that employs bad police and police that I love. And we have to be able to hold it all and deal with it, Carrie, and deal with it head on and change the system.
Michelle, I think this applies to something that when I knew you were going to be on tonight, I remembered a column that you wrote, and I think it was last fall in the Post. You talked about keeping a family photo by the front door of your house, and it's a photograph of your family on vacation, and it captures this wonderful moment of joy. You keep it there for a pretty ominous reason. Would you explain what you wrote about in the piece?
I keep it there because if police were ever to come to our home, I wanted them to know that we live in this home, that we're actually where we belong. And I did this because there were instances that I had heard about where people were getting swatted or police were showing up at someone's home and they would encounter a person of color and they wouldn't believe that they lived in the house that they were in. They would think that they were an intruder or something. And I was afraid that that might happen. And in my case, my husband and I were out of town. My son, my beautiful son was home. He loves tennis and he watches it all over the world. So in real time, so he's often up in the middle of the night and he's a college student. So lives a little bit like a vampire anyway. And he was up late and making a snack and he accidentally tripped the alarm, the burglar alarm in the house. And the police showed up in the house. And because of the neighborhood we live in, I guess, and because of the time of day and because he was flustered, you know, the police officers were asking him a lot of questions and we weren't home. And he remembered the picture by the front door. And he pointed to the picture by the front door and said, "That's me, that's us. This is our house." And it changed the encounter. And I'm so grateful that the police who showed up were kind and gentle with him in that moment and, you know, checked on him to make sure that he was okay. And I, you know, I echo what Sandra said. I want better for police. I want better policing and I want better for police. I have members of my family who've worked in law enforcement in Minneapolis, on the streets and in the courtrooms. And, but that the fact that I have to keep that photo by the front door speaks to the fear that I have, the fact that when my son goes out, I make him, both my sons, I ask them and my husband to keep a copy of their license in the visor, you know, right at their forehead level. So if the police ever were to pull them over, that instead of having to reach for a wallet, they could say, "I'm reaching up to give you a copy of my license so you can see it. And then if you want the real thing, then I'll reach," because I'm so afraid that if they make a movement, we've all heard of these stories about how bad things happen. And if you look at the way traffic stops are handled and the way bad things tend to happen to black and brown people during traffic stops at a much higher rate than white Americans. So these are the precautions that I take because of the reality of what policing is like for black and brown people. I want something better for my family, and I desperately want something better for America, and I want something better for the police officers like Lori who called in, who are worried about their fellow officers. I want something better for the families of police officers who are worried
about what happens when the community no longer looks to the police officers with the same kind of respect and instead holds them in rebuke. We need a better system all around.
Governor Walz is joining us, and I want to ask him about those very things, Michelle. Thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it from Washington, D.C. Sandra, double duty. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
It's been great to be with you. Thank you for providing this moment and this outlet for your listeners. Take care, all.
Yes. Thank you, Carrie.
Sandra, thank you. Turning now to Governor Tim Walz. Governor, welcome. It's good to have you on the phone.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
Did you hear what Michelle was saying about what she wants for the police? And I ask you that as I think about, I know there are police reforms that you're committed to, whether you fear that there's a kind of, well, the Chauvin trial is over, we got the verdicts that the community wanted, the inertia kind of sets in. What do you think?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do worry about that, Carrie, and it's going to be my responsibility to not let that happen. I have to use the office of governor to make those changes, those hopes and dreams, and those hopes. And again, I've said this, not only can black families not live like this, police can't live like this, white families can't live like this, and these changes are things that I think we can all agree upon. You should not be killed for a traffic stop, and the things you're talking about that black youth should not have to have an app that the minute they're pulled over starts recording and tells their parents where they're at. We can do better. And I believe Minnesotans want that. I don't understand where the political roadblock should fall on this. We know that if we do this right, everybody benefits. So I do worry about the inertia, but it's my responsibility now. Just like we said, we would keep folks safe here. We would allow folks to make sure this trial came to an end, and then we would get moving.
Governor, we started the day this morning at 9 a.m. talking about the image of Minnesota that is spreading around the world. I mean, you see the headlines, the video, the death of a 20-year-old kid in the middle of the Chauvin trial. I mean, you're kind of the CEO of the state. It's a terrible image. In your quiet moments, I'd really like to know what you think about that.
Yeah, and what I believe, I do worry about that, because what I know is this is an exceptional state. Well, on so many measures, this is a state with not just personal wealth, with resource wealth, with healthcare and educational
opportunities. But not if you're black.
Not if you're black. That's exactly right. And so what I say is that this is our opportunity to make sure that we no longer think we get a pat on the back for calling out this discrepancy, that there's an expectation to fix it. I came in running as an education governor, and closing that achievement gap was a priority. Because of COVID and everything else, now is the time. And this is where I'm going to go back to the legislature. We've been asking for 3 months because communities, especially black communities, have been saying, send us the resources for summer school and the things we need to do to get going. They need to do those types of things. So I do worry about this. But Carrie, what I think can come out of this is, I want this to be the place that said, you know what? Minnesota was the place where police officers showed integrity and did the right thing, where the courts convicted someone of doing this, and they're committed to getting it right. So if a black family says, we're going to move to Minnesota because that's a place that values us, and we're going to have to all of us across Minnesota decide that's where we want to go, because I'm certainly committed to it.
Some of this is, and I know you know this, there are a lot of, you talk about two different Minnesotas. There are a lot of different experiences of Minnesota. Isn't it persuading the people who don't live with the kind of fear, oppressive tactics, wealth gap, education gaps, it's persuading the people that don't live with that, as Michelle said earlier tonight, we are all connected, and it does matter to you, even if you live out in Minnetonka, and these are not your everyday problems. So
no,
how do you
do exactly
that?
Right. No, you're exactly right. And some of this is, and people don't want to talk about it, not having to worry about being pulled over is simply a reality for white, middle-aged men, women, or whatever. That's a little bit of that white privilege thing. That isn't, that is just stating a fact. And I think one of the things is, maybe you're thinking about this, I heard so many people tell me this, it's just so oppressive, this anxiety and all that. Black mothers say that's the way we feel when our kids go to soccer practice. And I think just showing that common humanity, and again, I really appreciate what the Attorney General in this did, is this was not an anti-police, this was pro-police. They don't want to have this happen. They live in our communities, and they want us to try and get at that. So I think it is showing this. The problem is when we pull it in and we start politicizing it. And again, I don't say that I'm naive or, you know, that all things being politicized is a pejorative, but this idea that you can't stand for these change because it somehow goes against your political beliefs. There should be nothing political about every family should be able to send their child off in a car and not worry, especially worry about the police. So you're right. It is about that. And I think it's about continuing to talk to our neighbors, continuing to decide this is one of the wealthiest states in the nation. There's plenty to go around. Let's make sure all of our neighbors can partake in that.
Governor, I have about 2 minutes. I wanted to ask you, if you're a law enforcement officer in a small community in rural Minnesota or in one of our larger cities, what should you be taking away from that verdict today?
Yeah, I think what you have much to share with people, and I've heard this brought up, and one of the things is in smaller communities, say I grew up in a town of, you know, 300 people, you know everyone. Community is there. And that's just a nature of you know, population density type of thing, but it's knowing that community. So a lot of these officers are saying, I don't get this. People know me. Yeah, because they played basketball with you. They know your parents. They know your uncle, your you know, your sister. What we need to make sure is that we're doing that of connecting and listening to that community again, listening to what they're asking for, and to recognize that public safety might not look the same everywhere else. And this issue about we may need to, and this whole false dichotomy of, you know, defund the police or whatever. No, we're talking about adding resources to things like mental health counseling or making sure that someone's there who understands that community. So I think the thing is people do stand with law enforcement when it's done right. And you saw integrity on the stand when the chief of police of Minneapolis stood up and said, this is not how things should be done. I don't agree with that. And that took courage and integrity. And I think it changes this narrative. That this doesn't have to be the police versus the police. And you'll see this with politics. Oh, we stand with the police. Certainly everyone does, unless they kneel on someone's neck and kills them, and we shouldn't. And I think that's what this has the chance of changing.
One last question here, Governor. There was quite a show of force under Operation Safety Net, and you know that there are a lot of questions about whether it was justified. It frightened some Minnesotans. I wonder, as you examine that, how you assess it.
Well, we did very carefully, and as I said, we certainly couldn't do it. And had we not seen Dante killed last week, the first thing you would have seen was yesterday of what was there to make sure. And again, our experience from May and June was how quickly those who wish to who seize on this for their own to burn down and to loot and things will poison what was angst and anxiety and honest First Amendment desire. And I needed to make sure this time that did not distract from this trial being held and being done correctly and people, as you see in the streets, doing what they need to do. So I recognize that. I know it's hard. What I would say is, though, if we don't want to have to do this again, we need to get into the legislature. We need to get into communities. We need to make the changes that these communities are asking for to make sure we're not back here.
I mean, we've got more trials. You've also got the case of Dante Wright. This isn't over, is it?
No, I would say, Gary, it's beginning. It is beginning, and that's what this was. And we should see this as the floor and go from here, because there's so much more to do. You're exactly right.
Governor, I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
Governor Tim Walz with us. You're listening to Special Coverage on the day that we have gotten the verdicts from the jury in the Chauvin trial. 3 guilties. I'm sure you know that by now. We're going to take a look at the latest news. We're going to continue our special coverage. We're going to talk about some of the questions that have come up about compliance. This has come up in the Dante Wright case. I'm also going to ask our guest, Bill Finney's going to be with us, former St. Paul police chief, about the message that these verdicts and the testimony of the officers sends to police officers throughout the state and throughout the country. More of your calls and questions, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can also join me on Twitter @CarrieNPR. Stay tuned. welcome to continued special coverage of the Chauvin trial verdict. We're going to continue our discussion this hour, but I have some new guests and some new questions, and I'd like you to think about whether we are witnessing the beginning of a culture change in policing. And here's the question to join the conversation with. What do you want police officers and police leaders to hear from we the citizens, from the citizens that they protect and serve? Are police departments listening well enough to what the citizenry wants? What would that be? Think about that. Join the conversation. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. Bill Finney is with us, former St. Paul Police Chief and current Ramsey County Undersheriff, and with us from St. Paul. And Chief, I'm really grateful for the time. I have a lot of questions for you, so thanks so much for joining us again.
My pleasure, Carrie.
Jose Santos is with us, an anthropologist and associate professor of social science in the College of Arts and Sciences at Metro State. And if you're a frequent listener to the show, you know that when we've kind of got a jumble of emotions and observations, I often turn to Jose to put it into some kind of context and meaning. So, Jose, thank you for stepping up to do that again, and it's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Yeah, I am so happy to be here on this day. Thank you for having me, Carrie.
I'm glad to have you. Chief, you and I talked earlier, or maybe it was late last week, about the meaning that Chief Arredondo and other officers testified in the courtroom. Much is being made of that. The question that comes to my mind is, was this just such an extreme case that they felt that they could break the code that often prevents officers from testifying against each other, or are we seeing something different happen here and that might have some kind of permanence?
Well, I think you're seeing the beginning of culture change within the organization, and the real good officers, and most of the officers really are good officers who want to provide public safety as a public servant. I think you're beginning to see that they're getting fed up with those individuals amongst us who often don't have those same values in mind. And so I was very, very proud to see that the Minneapolis police officers stood for what was just, what was proper. And they didn't hide behind the blue code of silence. They spoke out and said what was done was wrong by this former officer, and that this isn't the way they were trained, nor what they expect police officers to perform. So I think that's becoming more and more of a cause for the officers that want to see some reasonable transformation to our profession.
Because, Chief, what that would also mean is that there is policing in, you know, kind of away from the public gaze, inside the departments, peer-to-peer kind of policing, right? And I wonder if enough of that has gone on up till now. I think I hear you saying you see openings for more of that.
I think we need to have more of that. You know, during my time, my 12 years as police chief in St. Paul, I noted that about 65% of the complaints that came to my office against police officers were generated by about 5% of the police officers.
Really?
We could tell by the nature of the complaint, by what was said by the complainant, just about guess who the officer was.
Hmm. Jose, as an anthropologist, you study culture. You know how difficult it is to change a culture. I'd love to know what you think about the prospect of that.
I do agree that this is probably a really critical moment. This can be seen as a critical moment. And I think, yeah, we are in the middle of a big, huge culture change. And I think if one way for people to understand this a little better is to think of fear as this kind of giant blob that sits over society. Mm-hmm. And depending on how the power structure works, that fear blob is going to be spread more over some populations than others. right? So one example, for example, the fear of rape or the fear of sexual assault. Currently, that's spread over women far more than it is in men, far more,
right?
Fear around that. Now, with the Me Too movement and women speaking up about that, it made a lot of men anxious. It made a lot of men scared. It made a lot of men stop and think, wait a minute, whoa, have I ever done anything that was really bad? Is this going to come back? And I think that means from moving forward, that fear on the male side, the potential perpetrator side, is going to balance some things out, right? People are going to be like, I don't want to end up like a Weinstein. I don't want to end up like a Cosby. And so the fear moves a little bit from the side of one vulnerable population to the side that's a little less vulnerable, but now is afraid. I think something similar is happening here. And that is, as much as we're talking about accountability and such, it's really the thought, for example, as Bill was saying, that, you know, in the past, yeah, maybe it was only four or five guys doing this, but everybody else didn't say anything.
Right.
Everybody else sort of, for whatever reason, went along with it. And that's what structure does, right? Whether it's an institution like a school or the police force or the government, people just kind of go with the status quo. Well, now I think the Black community and other people of color and the indigenous communities have been screaming and they've been pushing that fear back onto government and back mm-hmm. onto the police, right? Mm-hmm. And so now I think those guys that were silent originally, you know, those men and women officers that were silent originally because they were afraid of their institution, they were afraid of the code of whatever, now they're going to be afraid of, wait a minute, you know, I'm not going down for you, pal. I'm not going down, because they know now people like Chauvin are getting put away. And so that's what I see as a critical moment, because now it pushes the fear in another direction.
Chief, you were going to say.
Yeah, you know, it's important for the listeners to understand. I think they realize this, so let me restate it. It's very difficult to fire a police officer, even when they've done something wrong. When I say something wrong, I'm not talking about so much the criminality of an officer, but violations of procedures, policies, and things that should get that officer dismissed. It's very difficult to do that. Officers are protected by an Officer Bill of Rights in Minnesota that says the complainant has to be identified. They have to know the nature of the complainant, and that all has to be known to the officer who's being complained against. Officers are protected by those that are veterans, the veteran preference laws, where they not only go through the civil process, but they also have a special veteran preference rule that allows them to be reviewed on whether or not they should be dismissed under that process. Police chiefs, the average big city police chief is only around about 3 years. Police chiefs are the only ones that have authority to discipline an officer and to dismiss them. Under Minnesota state law, the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, the police chief is called the CLEO, the Chief Law Enforcement Officers. They're the ones that can bring charges, or those that are appointed to be supervised underneath them, against a particular officer. Well, that officer has a whole process by which that decision to discipline them or dismiss them can be reviewed by an arbitrator. I can think of a case where one of my officers, off duty, living in another suburb, had a 13-year-old teenage babysitter that he molested. He was arrested by that local police department, and he was facing mm-hmm. a felony charge. I decided I'm getting rid of this guy. My union was in favor of saying we don't need that person there. Mm-hmm. But he pled guilty to a misdemeanor charge. Now it's harder to get rid of him. Went before an arbitrator. The arbitrator was a female. And she says, well, what business is it of the St. Paul Police Department that this officer had this situation in another community while off duty? My response was, well, the citizens of St. Paul expect that their police officers not be child molesters. She said, put that person back on the job, make him whole. It's not the St. Paul Police Department's business, and he pled guilty to a misdemeanor.
And went back to his job.
Yeah,
well,
and
he got paid. I wasn't going to let him come back to the job. You see, the police chief of St. Paul has the authority to say who polices in St. Paul. Now, maybe the city is on the hook for paying this individual, and we were, but it was my decision not to put them in a uniform, not to put them in a squad car. Matter of fact, former officer, in my mind, stay home. I don't need you around here. We'll send your check to you.
Jose, you were going to add?
Another person came forward, and we were able to get rid of him at that time.
Yeah.
But that shouldn't have happened. We had two female victims.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that Bill is just so open, and because this example really points out to people what we know in language, and that's that the problem is structural. The problem is permeating through the institutions, right? Even if we've got a police chief that's willing to go after some of these guys, there's other people that aren't, right? All the way down to, say, like the arbitrator. But what I think is good about the Chauvin trial and creating that accountability and showing, you know, you guys aren't invulnerable, right? Like the system isn't invulnerable, and that Black Lives do matter, is that all of a sudden now, maybe that arbitrator now is going to feel a little bit of that fear, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe all the people involved in the process. And so I think from a purely practical view of how do you get this culture change, and this is going to sound very extreme, but it is about transferring that fear, is that the Black community has a lot of rage and a lot of fear, right? I have students that I was talking to just the other day. One of them used to work with Dante, right? Another one, she and her boyfriend were pulled over by the same officer that shot Dante a couple of months ago. And we were talking in class, and what they were filled with was fear and terror. And so the trick, I think, to some culture change is to be able to do something to the system, like what happened today, where it shifts the power, it shifts accountability into a different direction. And now the people on the other side are going to feel some of that fear, right? That arbitration officer, the next time something like this comes up, maybe is going to be like, oh, crap, I could get in serious trouble. This could affect my life. And we'll think twice about what they're doing.
Right. This isn't just like some academic exercise here. Let me get to the phones. Jose Santos with us, an anthropologist and associate professor of social science at Metro State, and Bill Finney with us, a former St. Paul police chief. He's the current Ramsey County undersheriff. And as we get into hour two here on our special coverage, I've shifted the view a little bit. And you can hear us kind of talking about how the community takes back some of the power of policing and how we, the citizenry, we, the citizens, that the police are hired to protect and serve. What we want police departments and police leaders and police officers to hear about how we want to be policed. What do we want them to know? 651-227-6000 on Twitter at Carrie NPR to Paul in Fargo, North Dakota. Paul, I really appreciate you waiting.
Hi, Carrie.
I really wanted to hear from Bill and Jose, and thank you for hanging on, because it sounds like you've got a good question.
Yeah, my question is mainly to the police chief. I work in the media up here in Fargo, and my wife, she's a therapist in Fargo who works a lot with police, and we've been following the whole Chauvin thing for a while now. And the other night we were talking, and I posed a question to her. I know in her stressful situation, she talks to a therapist quite often just to make sure she keeps her head in check. My question for the police chief is, are officers, do they have therapists on hand? Because like you said, it's not an easy job, especially in larger markets like Minneapolis, Chicago, and L.A. and stuff. Is there counselors on hand to help those officers, especially after like a shooting situation where somebody is really wounded or killed? I guess I never really heard about any help for the police officers.
It's a good question, Chief, especially if the fear is as pervasive as, you know, as Jose is suggesting.
Well, it varies department to department. The St. Paul Police Department has an employee assistance program. It began initially to deal with officers who had alcohol addiction. It expanded to officers that had other problems. And it's something that really is great value to St. Paul police officers. I, as chief of police, would sometimes see that we had an officer who was troubled by one thing or another. And that report would come to me from supervisors or whatever. Now, my concern was that I have my officer get healthy. And so I would say, officer, I want you to go out to employee assistance program, and I'm going to know if you get there because they'll give me a report that you did arrive. Now, I don't want to know the nature of the business. All I wanted from the counselor was to know that the officer was seeking help and getting straightened out. Or if the officer was a danger to someone inside the community, inside the office, or to themselves, now they had to let me know that then, because then I had to take other measures to make sure that we relieved the officer of anything that could harm them. But other than that, my concern was that the officer get help, be healthy, and come back and serve the community properly.
Catherine says on Twitter, what do I want police officers to know? I want them to know that they don't need to put their hand on their holster when my sweetheart, who is a tall brown man, opens the door. I want them to know it's time to move beyond fear-based policing and beyond warrior training. To the phones to Jay in Golden Valley. Hi, Jay. Thanks so much for waiting. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, similar point, and just full disclosure, I'm a middle-aged white guy. I'm an attorney. I don't practice in this area, but I mean, as disturbing and deeply disturbing as the Derek Chauvin video is of him kneeling on George Floyd's neck for all that time, almost as disturbing, and in a sense more disturbing to me, is to see these rookie cops approaching George Floyd, guns drawn, dropping F-bombs, being super aggressive, super, you know, just confrontational. Like, I am not okay with that. And I mean, kind of going to former chief's point, like, can we just not fire guys like that? We see one video of that. To me, it's enough. We not fire guys like that. We just pay them out their salary until retirement for picking garbage in Minneapolis or whatever. And it's still even cheaper than these multi-million dollar payouts. Like, just that's not even like a review or just like, nope, you're not cut out for this. I mean, and these guys had just finished their training.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a good question. Yeah, Chief, go ahead.
Yes, a very, very important point. Citizens in their town have to select their chief law enforcement officer very carefully. You have to know that chief law enforcement officer knows what your concerns are, knows what your expectations are of that police department, and then you hold that chief law enforcement officer accountable for the actions of their department. That is so critically important. Police chiefs, remember, police chiefs are the only ones that have the authority to discipline those officers. And it's difficult for them to do that, but they have the authority. If an officer's wrong, you have to know, I want that chief to straighten out that situation with that officer. If necessary, make that officer former police. And a police chief has to hear that message and act on what it is you on your concerns.
Jose,
yeah, there's,
go ahead.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, I have a question, but go ahead.
Sort of anecdote to go along with that, because I think Bill's right? It is about leadership, and that's critical. But I think it's also culture is insidious, and like the caller was saying, you know, you've got these young guys coming in, and they'll have a certain mindset as they're coming in that was built by things that they experienced before they came in, right? And then of course whatever they went through early on. I had an incident maybe not quite 10 years ago when I was living in downtown St. Paul. I was assaulted by a drunk man. While I was actually on the phone, he was following me for a while. So I had 911 on the phone. He takes a swing at me. And then I start screaming into the phone. Eventually in the long shot, like I knocked him out. I became angry and upset and everything. And I was a younger man. I could knock him out. I did. Three officers arrived. One was immediately concerned with my safety. My dog was with me. And she was like, you know, would you like to put the dog in the car? Do you need a ride home? All that. The other one was all business, you know, what's your name, this, that, or the other. The third was a young man who I put somewhere around 23, maybe, at the most. And he kind of looked at the man passed out on the ground, and then he looked at me, and then he looked down at the man again, completely passed out. And then he looked at me and I thought, oh man, am I really in trouble? And he looked at me and he said, good job, sir. and then I realized, right. And then he made kind of like this little gesture, like, once he was walked past me to the other officers, of like a fist hitting his other hand that was open. Like, you know, this guy really smacked him down. The first officer said, I don't ever want to see that again. Right. The other one said nothing.
Wow.
So maybe half an hour later, I'm walking home, and the two second officers, right, the younger one and the one that was all business, they pull up to me in their squad car, roll the window down, look at me and say, good for you, keep at it, and then drive off.
And what do you take from that?
The idea there was, you know, keep kicking ass, keep beating people down, right? Like, that way to go, man, way to go. And I was thinking, oh my God, they gave this kid a gun. And so on the one hand, leadership is great. Well, leadership can hold accountable. Let's be honest, Bill probably knows this. There's just so many cops and there's so many people that you'd need to be enforcing. You can't be vigilant over every situation. Right. So what I'm suggesting is for the culture shift to happen is that there needs to be a very loud and clear message before this kid even signs up, right, for the police force, that if he were to, that's not the kind of thing he wants to do, because that will get him in trouble. That will land him in a place he doesn't want to be. And I think that's what's happening, right? I think that's what the Black Lives Matter movement is about, is making that noise and saying this stuff is wrong and trying to get enough people to see things that way. So that the culture itself isn't producing so many people that would do this.
Chief, I just have one follow-up here, and then we're going to go back to the phones. But I've thought about this so often. What prevented the other officers that were witnessing? And I know one of them went over to, shouldn't we turn him over with the Chauvin? Yeah, I mean, what was it that stopped the bystanding police officers from seriously intervening? And how do you...
Fear of losing his job. You had a rookie officer who was on probation. You had a veteran officer with his knee on the neck of a helpless individual. That officer was in kind of, in my mind, a no-win situation. If you would have insisted and intervened, that senior officer could have made sure he was no longer a police officer by saying he didn't listen to the authority of the senior officer on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Police chiefs, after you select your police chief, you have to make sure they look to select the best people possible to be police officers. And I'm not talking about looking for people who want to be law enforcers. You're looking for people who want to be public servants, people that want to render public service in public safety. You can teach a public service-minded person to be a person that knows how to enforce the law. If you have a law enforcement-minded person who thinks that their job is to make sure people comply, it's difficult to teach that person how to be a public servant. You see, that person kind of sees themselves as a hammer and everybody else as a nail.
Right.
Those are difficult people to control when they're out of the sight of the supervising people all the way to the police chief. So the chief has to hear the message of the community. The community has to insist that they want to be served. All communities, rich communities, poor communities, white communities, brown and black and yellow communities, they all deserve public service from their public police department. You serve the community, you police those that break the law. There's a difference there. Everybody doesn't need to be police. Most people need police service when they call. You police the ones that break the law.
You're listening to a conversation in our special coverage today of the Chauvin trial verdicts about changing police culture. What we've seen on this video in the Floyd trial with three other officers coming up for trial later in the summer, how difficult it seems to be to reach the departments that serve us and really affect some change. I mean, as a citizen, maybe you feel like they're just not listening. What do you want these departments to hear as a citizen? That they are protecting and serving. As the chief just said, service is the essence. It's the foundational organizational principle of what police departments are supposed to do, no matter who you are in that community. What do you want them to hear? Do they seem to be listening? If you're getting a busy signal, try me on Twitter at @CarrieNPR, 651-227-6000. Anywhere in the upper Midwest, 800-242-2828. To Michelle in Minneapolis. Hi, Michelle. Thank you very much for waiting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So glad you called. What are you thinking about?
So I was out at the march by the Hennepin County Government Center today. I organized with TCC for J, Twin Cities mm-hmm. Coalition for Justice for Jamar Clark. Mm-hmm. They're thinking about the next step here in creating accountability. And I think that the next step is CPAC. It's a Civilian Police Accountability Commission, which we are petitioning right now for an amendment to the Minneapolis City Charter to create this commission. It would be 13 people all elected from the community who would have experience in protecting the rights of marginalized folks, would not be cops, and they would be a council that created real community control of the police. They would have hiring and firing power over officers and be required to investigate reports of misconduct. And so I think that establishing that community control of the police with real power behind it is the next step. And it would allow communities to self-determine what they wanted their policing to look like.
I mean, this is interesting. Yeah. This is much further than a civilian review board. Jose, what do you hear in the idea?
Yeah. Actually, is Michelle still there? Are you still there,
I'm
Michelle?
I'm still here.
Okay. I wonder if I'm still here. I think this is important, right? Because I think there's plenty of people that are listening and are going to think, that's a great idea. There's other ones it's going to be a terrible idea and so on. And it sounds like you guys are going to go forward and you're going to try for the idea one way or the other. But one thing I really want to talk about is how useful it is to get together as a community and just move in a direction, right? Whether it ends up this way or not with your CPAC or not, how did it feel to get together with others to be able to discuss this and think about what kind of community do we want to have? How did that feel for you guys?
I think that it's extremely important. It felt like, you know, especially as, so I personally am white and I've started working more recently with TCC for J. They've been working on this legislation for, I think, several years now. To establish a CPAC, but just sitting down to listen to the stories of community members in my community who are BIPOC folks, and how they feel that, you know, the police do not protect them in their own communities. They feel that the police make them less safe in those communities. And then also folks who feel that police do offer some measure of protection in their community, like, you know, no matter where you stand on that, having the power in your community to self-determine with other members of your community what you want that policing to look like, that's so important.
So, Jose, I gather that you're asking about that because, again, as you said, this may not happen, but there is power and what a sense of asserting yourself over what feels like an out of control situation. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's the twin thing of realizing, wait a minute, I'm not the only one that thinks the way that I do. I'm not the only one that sees a disaster here. And then the other thing is like, hey, you get enough people together and you start feeling like you can change things. And I think an additional thing which we forget is the power of our imaginations to literally look at something that's so wrong and think, how could it be?
Mm-hmm. And if you let yourself imagine that world, that's when you can start walking towards it. You can't walk towards that world if you can't imagine it, right? And I think we're in a place now where people feel, you know, let's face it, none of this stuff is new, right? People have been oppressed by law enforcement, by militaries, by governments for a long time. And the Black community has suffered that. But I think they're in a historical moment now where we're going to imagine a different future. And here's the plan, literally handing it over to the government, right? Like this CPAC plan, they're going to hand over that plan and say, here's our vision for a better world. And I think in some ways, sometimes we feel like we don't even have a right to imagine it being different. Right.
Idealism. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. When you're sitting there quiet, like if you think of like those rookies that Bill was just talking about, they're sitting there watching this happen, but they didn't even feel like they had the right to say anything because they're so trapped. They are in a no-win situation. They feel like they can't even imagine what could I do to change this. And so once people are freed a little bit from the vise, a little bit, the structure is a little bit freer, they can imagine these things and then move forward with them, right? And I think that's the beauty of what Michelle is describing. You can be a part of that, right? That collective imagining and that collective production of a new place, of a new society.
Chief, I've been eager to ask you about something that is coming up in some of the listener calls that we're getting and some of the emails in the Dante Wright situation, which is people who will say they've watched the video. They will say, well, if he had complied with the orders, if he hadn't, you know, dashed back into his car and looked like he was going to take off. And I think this is another really sticky area that people of different backgrounds and races see quite differently. So I thought you might, for just a moment, talk about compliance and why we come to that with a lot of different expectations and experience.
I am a Black man. I've been a Black man my entire life. I've been a police officer since 1969. So I've had a long time as a police officer, but I have a lifetime as being a Black man. I've known Black people who have been the victims of bad policing, of individual Black police officers. The Black experience, especially the Black experience for young Black men and police, is not always positive. More times than not, it may not be. Police officers have to understand, in my mind, that it is a privilege to be a police officer, a privilege that they must earn every day. Being a police officer is not a right. And once you become that officer, you have a right to keep that job, heck or high water. That's not the way it should be. Police officers are asked to do very, very dangerous things. We expect them to go into harm's way on our behalf. When they do that, and they do those things lawfully and in accordance with policy and good procedures, we as a community, we the entire community, must support those police officers in their lawful actions. They're doing that on our behalf. When they do things on a personal agenda, like we just saw in this last trial, then we have to find ways to make those individuals former police. Situations with young men, we had a training officer in Brooklyn Center, and she had a rookie police officer. Part of a rookie police officer's training is to learn how to take what they learn in police school, police academy, skills courses, and then to be able to apply that on the street. The field training officer is expecting the officer and grading the officer every day. Part of that is to say, okay, today we're going to go out and we're going to find vehicles that are unlawful or out of sorts, and I want you to articulate, we're going to make a car stop, and what the purpose is for the car stop. Unfortunately, in Minnesota, we have a backlog in expired tabs. $600,000. So there's a lot of vehicles that are running with expired tabs where the owners would like to have, you know, current tabs. Mm-hmm. But that is a lawful police stop when you see a vehicle that has expired tabs. You want your rookie to be able to observe and to see that and to make a proper police stop. The situation went bad after that in Brooklyn Center because when checking the individual, you find out that individual has a warrant. So I won't articulate on the rest of that, but I can see how that stop might have been initiated with a rookie officer and then how it went badly.
But you can also see, I think, what I'm asking about, you know, a white Minnesotan who's never been ordered to do anything by a police officer understands compliance, right? Do what the officer says differently than somebody who's been stopped 25 times and, you know, has grown accustomed to what they think is unfair, you know, being unfairly hounded by police. Do you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
I think, yeah.
In the white community, people understand that the police officers are working on their behalf. They feel
right,
that.
Right.
They've been taught that. When officers stop me, oh, I must have done something wrong. The officer's here to let me know what I did wrong, and if I was speeding or whatever, I expect I should get a ticket. From the black community perspective, it's like, why are they stopping me again? What did I do wrong this time? I didn't know. So you're on guard. And then if we have an officer that is not as respectful, one of the tenets of the St. Paul Police Department, they put it on the side of the car, is trusted service with respect.
Hmm.
And Chief Axtell expects that his police officers, each and every one of them, will handle each encounter with our citizens with trusted service with respect. That's inculcated in how he expects his officers to do business. Often that isn't the case. And often there's an apprehension on that on behalf of young black and brown people, especially young black and brown men, that the police officer will not meet you with that respect. Most times, when police officers get themselves in trouble with citizens, it's because they were disrespectful. Not because they were heavy-handed, not because they pulled a gun, but because they didn't treat that individual citizen with respect through snide comments, through sarcastic comments, to saying things that puts them on edge and becomes an obstacle to good communication.
So, Jose, what were you going to add to that?
Yeah, I wanted to add a little bit about this, I think, is critically important because it goes back to what direction is culture going in. So notice when we're talking about Dante, you can have two sets of people that are looking at the exact same thing, watching the exact same video and coming to two completely different conclusions.
Right. Absolutely.
Right? And one story is, well, that guy should have complied. And the other story is, why do cops keep shooting people? Why do they keep killing people? And so in some ways, what this transition period that I think we're going through is about is that those two stories are vying for power. Those two stories are duking it out in the public imagination. And the thing is whichever story has more power behind it is actually the one that's going to prevail, right? Because those two stories existed previous to this, but the black community had very little power in the past, right? There was just a period where no one would listen to it, no one would believe. And now that's changing. And I think a part of that really does have to do with technology. It really does have to do with now we got the video, right?
Right.
And so that technology is creating part of a power shift to change these narratives. Instead of like, why should I have to comply with somebody who kills people that look like me?
Mm-hmm.
Right. I like I said, I had a student who was pulled over a couple months ago by the same officer that shot Dante.
And her experience was one of like, it's as if, you know, a hurricane had destroyed the house next door. Like, that could have been me. I could be dead now. Right. And that's the narrative, I think, that is being pushed out there, and that today won a victory.
Right.
Because people are realizing we're all looking at the same video now. But wow, I really do see it differently now. Now, what makes us see it one way or the other? It's very complex. You talk about everything from socialization to the media to where you were brought up, right? What your race is and therefore how people treated you and so on and so forth. But in the end, it is about which perspective is going to dominate. And if the perspective that dominates is people shouldn't get shot, that's when you'll get change. If the perspective that dominates is you should always comply to authority, that's literally a recipe for the status quo. Right?
You're listening to Special Coverage. Jose, if I might, you're listening to Special Coverage on the day of the verdicts in the Chauvin trial. And we're having a conversation about police culture and what we as citizens want from our police departments and whether they're listening to what the citizenry wants. Jose Santos with us, an anthropologist and assistant professor of social science at Metro State. And Bill Finney, a former police chief and current Ramsey County undersheriff. I want to go back to the phones here and take a call from Sky in St. Paul. Sky, hi. It's good to have you on the show. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for having me.
What do you want to say?
Yeah, so I am of the mindset of a lot of people that I think in my kind of age demographic now, you know, between 20s and 30s, that's all for the complete abolition of the police forces as they currently stand. I am a person of color. In my lifetime, I have seen a lot of trauma and, you know, just awful things at the hands of my communities, you know, from the police forces. And I think that there's really not much change that can be done because it's such a systemic problem that the whole thing needs to just be completely abolished. And, you know, I think that community building and support and taking the money that we would be pouring into police forces and giving them to communities for building homeless shelters, making sure that folks have mental health resources and even access to food and water will do far more good for those communities than continuing to police them, and especially with such a heavily militarized police force.
Sky, let me ask you something, because we've got a show coming on Thursday about mental health responders and departments starting to give those calls to people who really understand how to deal with it. What if the police, what if the mission of the police department was more refined and distilled, and a lot of, you know, mental health calls and some of the other calls that police officers get some training on but aren't experts on, and you still maintain kind of the, when there's somebody breaking into your house, you dial 911 and a police officer shows up. Do you have hope for something like that? Or you think the culture just cannot be changed?
Yeah, I fundamentally believe that the culture cannot be changed in a way that is most equitable for people of color, communities of color. I don't think that cops should answer mental health calls at all, because as we've seen historically, especially with handling communities of color and, you know, folks of color who do have mental health issues, it often is deadly for them. It's not a positive experience. And if we can keep that harm from happening in the first place by having first responders that are mental health crisis folks, that does a lot more good, I think, for those communities, especially when folks are having mental health crises. I know that Minneapolis does have a mental health crisis line and a task force that does come out depending on what neighborhood you're in that they can access in Minneapolis. And I have sat with folks during these types of interventions, and that has been so much more safe, even though they were told that they had to call the police as well. But I was at that point in time, it was my home. So I told them I didn't want the police to come in, but only the mental health providers.
Right. Let me take what you've said and what I was asking you about to Chief Finney. Chief, are police officers just asked to do too much? And you hear Sky saying, I think we need to start from the ground up. But do you feel like the kinds of changes that we started discussing will bring us back to the core purpose of policing?
Police officers are often asked to handle tasks that other institutes, organizations used to handle. They are not handling it anymore, and the people say, let the police handle it. Case in point, before the presidency of Ronald Reagan, there used to be a lot of mental health institutions.
Right.
He closed those. Well, those people, the thought was, well, to keep these people properly medicated, that they'll be good citizens again and not a burden to anybody else. Well, the problem is they're mentally ill and they haven't been cured. And so they feel maybe that they're cured and they stop taking their medication and they go into crisis. Or they stop self-medicating and they go into the crisis. Not having any institution to handle that, call the police. 911. Families have a person that has mental illness, they can't handle them, call the police. 911. The police get there, and these people, because they're mentally ill, may act out in an unpredictable manner. Often it's violent, which is why the family called the police in the first place.
Right.
And so it gets to be a bad situation. Police were saddled with that, didn't ask for that job, but got it because there was nobody else that was going to do the job. There's many things that police are well situated to handle. They have big crimes of violence. We've seen a lot of mass shootings here lately. You know,
right.
Active mass shootings.
Yeah. Yes, where police officers run to danger. Right.
Who are you going to ask to do that? Certainly a person that has a great college degree and can solve things through conversation is not going to be able to handle that because it's beyond conversation. Shooting is occurring. People are dying. You have to have people that are trained, that will run into harm's way on behalf of the public in general. So I hear that there needs to be some changes, some reforming of police departments, some transformation of how it is we do business, and maybe a clear mission statement for what it is you expect your police officers and police departments to do. And then those things that you don't think they should be doing or you think can be done better by somebody else will then establish that entity.
Yeah, absolutely. And because I think that does two things that are really important. And something that we haven't actually discussed is the amount of trauma that police themselves go through.
That's right.
Because this is very traumatic for them, right? And that's something that deserves our sympathy and compassion. But if we think of just something like a simple traffic stop, we have created a system in which traffic stops are potentially deadly, right? So if you can imagine it, you know, you're getting pulled over, right? You're a young black man and you're like, crap, I could get shot here. Now, if you're a cop, you're like, I don't know what's in that car. I don't know what's going on. And if you don't believe me, feel free to get on YouTube. There are plenty of videos of police getting murdered simply for having pulled somebody over. And that's a reality. Right. And so the police officer is also terrorized. OK. And so we've created a situation where getting pulled over is terrifying for people, both the officer that's pulling people over and the person that's being pulled over. And that has the threat of deadly force because there's a gun involved. Right. At least on the officer's side, potentially also the passenger. And so that's where it's like you really see we're creating these recipes for disaster. Couldn't we have a system where traffic stops are done by somebody that's not carrying a gun, right? So that if something really, really bad is going on, the person doesn't feel I need to kill this officer in order to get away. I'll just drive off. And the policy is do not pursue, right? Why pursue? Why not take a picture of their license plate, take a picture of their photo, right? Send a drone after them, whatever it might be, or send the people with deadly force after that person has already proved that they're a danger. But notice our system, I think, to go back to something that Mr. Finney said.
I've got about a minute, Jose.
Yeah, it's a hammer, and it sees everything as a nail. And it's not all nails out there. Some of it is just traffic stops.
Hey, I appreciate both of you. Thank you so much for the hour and for being part of the special coverage today. Chief Finney, thank you.
Thank you.
And Jose, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Carrie. Thank you so much.
Jose Santos is an anthropologist, associate professor of social science at Metro State. And Bill Finney is former St. Paul police chief and current Ramsey County undersheriff. On Thursday morning, we're going to talk about these police departments across the country who have created robust mental health responders. In fact, they are taking hundreds of calls off of the call sheets of police departments. Problem is, they're not getting the kind of funding to build out these units. So we're going to talk about that on Thursday. On Friday morning, why so much military gear? Why so many military tactics in police departments? That's our continued special coverage this week, and I hope you'll listen in. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!